Hello, my name's Dr. Vivian Miller, and I'm with Dr. Alan Barclay. We're the two doctors who are discussing nutrition and lifestyle and healthy living and some recipes and a few other odds and ends. I am a GP of 35 years' experience. I've got special education in cardiology, diabetes, basically health and welfare. I'm interested in all forms of healthy living and general medicine. Alan, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Thanks, Vivian. Good to chat with you again. Yeah, Alan Barclay, accredited practicing dietitian and nutritionist, and also chef with over 30 years' experience in clinical dietetics, public health, and academia. And yeah, we're sharing our passion in particular about food and nutrition, but healthy lifestyles in general.
Yes, and our aim is to try to share with the public some of the education and information that we have, and to make it a bit easier for you to have a healthier lifestyle. Okay, Alan, so today we're going to be discussing fiber, is that correct?
Yeah, well, that's right. We've talked about it or touched upon it quite a bit in everything that we've spoken about so far. So I thought it'd be really good to do a little bit of a deeper dive into dietary fibers because there are many of them. And that's part of what we should be discussing. There are many kinds of fibers and they have many benefits for us as far as we know at this point in time from a scientific perspective.
I think that the general public don't really understand fiber. It's like the mysterious part of nutrition. Are you able to explain to us what fiber actually is? Because I understand you've got specific expertise on this subject.
Yes, so of course my PhD was in carbohydrates and chronic disease, and people don't actually realize that fiber is a kind of carbohydrate. It's by definition the indigestible kind of carbohydrate. And as we touched on in our previous discussion, when people go on a low carb diet, they often unfortunately reduce their fiber intake. And that's certainly what's been happening in Australia, as we'll get to a bit later. But as far as a definition, it's mostly the part of plants that we eat that aren't digested as they pass through our body. And digestion starts in our mouth, of course, with salivary amylase and chewing, continues in the stomach with releases of acids, and then in our intestine with digestive enzymes and bile and what have you, all the way through as it passes through the colon, the bacteria and other microorganisms in the bowel will break it down as well. So as it passes through. So it's those pieces that don't get digested by our own digestive enzymes and end up in the gut, where some of the bacteria will break down some of those fibers. And what's left gets passed through as a stool. So that's it in a nutshell, but it is a physiological classification. And I think that's where it and glycemic index differ from most other concepts in human nutrition. So the fiber itself must have a benefit for humans. And one of those is laxation, which of course most of us are more familiar with, but the other two are actually
As
blood
opposed to
glucose and blood
reflex,
cholesterol.
relaxation.
Sorry, what was that?
As opposed to relaxation, can you
Yes.
explain what laxation
Oh, yes. Sorry, medical speak. Of course, really,
is?
it's just passing a stool, going to toilet, number twos, if you prefer. So it's having a bowel movement. And yes, so that's the polite way of saying these things, I guess. So, whereas, of course, blood cholesterol and blood glucose are not particularly controversial, but it has to have one of those three benefits in humans in order for it to be considered a dietary fiber. So, is that clear enough for you, Vivian? Is that enough? Yep.
I think so. I would just query one thing which you might be able to explain. There are different types of fiber. You mentioned that before. Can you explain what they are?
Well, there are many types of fiber, and we have been talking, and I'm talking about my colleagues and I and the International Carbohydrate Quality Consortium, who wrote a paper on fibers back in 2020 now. But we shouldn't be talking about dietary fiber as a single entity. It is dietary fibers, there's a whole variety of different ones. And when you think about the main sources, so we get fibers from fruits and vegetables, but also from cereal grains, you know, whether that's wheat or oats or barley or what have you. Nuts and seeds are also a source of fiber. And there are other pulses as well that we eat, and even seaweed, believe it or not, has a little bit. So there are many different kinds, and these can be broken down into gums and mucilages and pectins and what have you, things that most people aren't familiar with and probably don't need to know. But I think the important thing is that it's a variety of different chemical substances that aren't digested, and that they do have different effects. And that's why the definition I talked about at the beginning is from Codex Alimentarius, which is the global standards of food and nutrition definition. So it can have the effect, and some of the fibers bind cholesterol or bile, for example, in the gut, and that helps lower cholesterol, where others slow the absorption of carbohydrates, available carbohydrates, into the small intestine. That affects blood glucose. And then the ones that most people are familiar with go through to the large bowel, where they bulk out the stools and bacteria can ferment them. So, there are many different types. We lump them all together. The bottom line is it's good to have many different kinds, and I think it fits with our broader dietary guidelines, to have as many different foods you can each day. I do like one of the Japanese one, which is to have 30 different foods each day, which sounds scary. But if you had a natural muesli, you could probably have about 10 in that, by itself, let alone the milk and if you had some fruit to it. So it's not as difficult as people think it is. But variety is really important. Different kinds of fibers will have different functions. And of course, lastly, is to get them from food. Now, you can buy a whole variety of fibers from the supermarket or the chemist, and there's some very popular ones, and they are effective. But they'll generally have an effect on laxation, bowel movements, but maybe not so much the effects on the other known benefits like blood glucose and cholesterol. And that's why in the US, but not currently here, they actually break the label down into naturally occurring and added fibers.
And I guess that's the interesting part of where your job and my job cross, because from my point of view, there's a lot of talk about gut microbiome, as you're well aware, in your area of expertise there is too. And the gut microbiome is largely experimental, in my opinion, at the moment, but it's a very interesting area of experimental medicine and nutrition. And it's, as you say, if you are using supplements. In other words, things that you cannot actually see the raw food that is within that supplement. There's a lot of fiber supplements on the market, for example, in bottles and containers and powders. If you use those, you don't know what effect the microbiome is having from those supplements. You lose a lot of multivitamins, you lose a lot of minerals, you lose a lot of trace elements. It's always better to get things from the actual diet. And there's a lot to be said from if you can't see the food that you're eating, you can't see the individual components of what you're eating, it's too refined. And I think that's really actually quite important. And unfortunately for a lot of us, busy as we might be, it comes down to the fact that you really have to cook for yourself a lot of the time or to be careful where you source your foods from if you use takeaway, because otherwise you're going to lose these trace nutrients, you're going to lose the fiber. A lot of takeaway is low in fiber, and you get the control back. And your microbiome is always going to be healthier if you use fresh fruit and vegetables. And here I'm declaring my bias at this point, being a vegetarian, but as you also say, 30 different types of food a day. Interesting concept. I've said before, I get disappointed with myself if I have less than about 7 or 8 different types of vegetable at dinner. And it doesn't have to be a lot, you know? It's just different types, small amounts of different types to add up. I'm not suggesting that you eat 7 whole vegetables themselves. But if you want to, go ahead. Anyway, so from your point of view, how would you suggest that people get fiber in their diet?
Well, I totally agree with you, Vivian, is to have it from whole foods and to have a variety of foods. And just to circle back to your microbiome point, which I think is really important, the more variety of foods you have, the more variety of microbes you have in your gut. And I think that's a really important concept. I agree, although there's an awful lot of research in there, and I think it's fascinating, it's still early stages, and we don't really know what it all means yet, though we will no doubt get there one day. And I think the important thing is, to make your gut microbiome healthy is to make sure you have a whole variety of foods that are high in various fibers, and that will help the variety of the microbiome, which seems to be the overarching principle for good health there. So, what are the sources? Well,
I'm going to stop you at that point, because one of the really big problems I have is trying to persuade teenagers and young adults to eat more vegetables, and I have no idea how to do it. And I brought my children up as mainly vegetarian, and I still couldn't do it. So, have you any suggestions?
It's not
it
just
seems to me that your brain has to, your brain has to develop enough to actually realize that you can eat these things and enjoy them. I don't know.
It's a problem, Vivian. It's not just teenagers, of course, young people in general, children, and it's the bane of most parents' lives, of course. I think there's a whole range of things that we can do. And part of it, children have a strong preference for sweet things when they're born. Of course, the first food is milk, and that is sweet from the lactose. So they prefer fruits to vegetables. And dare I say, and I have to be cautious how I say this, but some of the vegetables in Australia can be bitter. Not all of them. And when you travel to other parts of the world, for example, Europe, the same varieties will actually be sweeter. And I think partly it's because they're grown in different soils, they're picked at different levels of maturation, and the preparation techniques are also different to what we do here. And therefore, when I go to Europe, everybody eats vegetables, like the Mediterranean diet is very heavily based on that. And I think they do taste better. So, I think being careful in what you buy, buying good quality produce, the best you can afford, and making sure you cook it optimally will help improve the taste and texture, but also leading by example. And, when our children were young, and I'm going back about 30 years now, we used to have exactly the same meals. My wife used to blend up the vegetables that we ate, so that the kids would have them pureed, and the fruits obviously were pureed as well. And then when they were older, they ate the same foods that we did. There were no special children food, and they saw us eating these foods, saw that we enjoyed them. We prepared them in a way that we thought was appropriate for them. And that's what's happened throughout their life. So, and then when my
Yeah,
children,
well, I tried that. It didn't work.
Look, like everybody's different.
About
Yeah, everybody is different.
Yeah.
And I think we mustn't pretend that. So, it's hard not to give generic advice. But, and I think, as they get older, I did get them to prepare food with us. So both my wife and I, so that they learnt the skills. And I think, that doesn't happen at school anymore. So it's up to parents to teach them. And, so there used to be mandatory home economics when we were children. But that is not a mandatory subject anymore. So children don't necessarily know how to prepare food and know what good food is. So I think you've got to lead by example.
Sometimes,
So,
and the parents sometimes don't know either.
Exactly,
actually,
that's right. So how are they going to teach them?
And they don't know how to cook the foods as well.
So,
and not everybody has the time or the interest to look up recipes.
Exactly.
But there's tons of them out there, and it's very, very easy, actually. It only takes a few minutes. If you can read and use a computer, it's actually really, really quick. And you build on your knowledge base.
Yeah.
It's very simple once you get the hang of it. So
YouTube
one
is
message
wonderful.
I would get out there.
Yeah, and then that's a relatively modern thing that people can go on and see people prepare it online and then give it a go themselves. So I think that's an emerging technology, which is wonderful. Another thing that's emerging is you can get either the pre-packaged, I won't mention any brand names, but you can get deliveries of all the ingredients that you then just assemble yourself. So you're not doing the food prep, and it's all the right ingredients. So it's easy to make a meal from these pre-prepared, or you can go to your local supermarket or greengrocer and get, a pre-prepared mix of, say, salads or mixed stir-fry vegetables or even mixed frozen vegetables. For those who don't have the skills, you can use those and make a good meal as a base based on these high fiber vegetables.
Yeah.
And don't be afraid to use a dressing. I still find, we went through 20 years of fat is evil from the 80s up until, the late 90s. And people, still don't feel comfortable with adding a dressing. And I think that's a problem in the Mediterranean. Again, they will put some sort of a balsamic vinaigrette style, mix with olive oil, maybe a bit of
Correct.
salt and pepper, or like the French dressing has mustard in it. They do add flavor to the vegetables, and if that's going to help people to eat them, the small amount of fat in there, which is olive oil, or another healthy fat, is fine. You don't have to have boiled or steamed veggies with nothing on them. And I think that hangover from those anti-fat days still lingers, and it's a problem because plain vegetables by themselves are pretty boring and kids won't eat them. So make sure you dress the vegetables in a way that makes them edible and the kids will enjoy them as part of a broader healthy eating pattern. And they're my thoughts from a practical perspective based on my clinical experience, but also my personal experience too as a parent.
I would add to that. I think that's an excellent idea. Very, very simple salad dressings, half a teaspoon of sugar, some mustard, some ground up garlic, some olive oil, balsamic vinegar, and it's really, really nice. My other suggestion would be to crumble some feta cheese or some grated cheddar cheese on cauliflower or broccoli because calcium is important as well. But we'll talk about that on another day, perhaps next time. Another deficient mineral that people lack. And as far as the elderly go, now this is the other big group I see in medicine. And part of the reason why we need a lot of fiber is because fiber deficient diets lead to chronic constipation. You get issues like diverticulosis, which are little hernias, out pouches in the bowel wall, in between the muscles of the bowel that catch bits of feces and become infected. They're extremely common by the time you're 60 in our society, and strongly related to low fiber diets and chronic constipation. By the time you're 80, they can become a real problem if you become recurrently prone to these infections, and people can actually need to have sections of bowel removed if it's very serious. If they keep flaring up, they behave like appendicitis, and so the only treatment definitively is to operate, and that is not what you want in your 70s or 80s. So management of that condition by having a high fiber diet. Now, there's a lot of controversy about whether or not people with diverticulitis, who are prone to diverticulitis, not during an acute outbreak necessarily, are able to have seeds, for example, or even bits of chopped up carrots. And I see no problem as long as they grind it up well in their mouth. But what do you think?
Yeah, that does come up, Vivian. My understanding of the latest evidence is that you don't need to avoid nuts or seeds if you've got diverticulosis, that on the best
That's what I
evidence
say.
that we have. You can't really do randomized controlled trials here, so it's more observational. But I think, that's the accumulated evidence is you don't need to, as you say, and I think that gets to a broader issue. Most people don't chew properly. We're sort of a bite and swallow society these days, and maybe that's because of some of the soft over-processed foods that don't have enough fiber. High-fiber foods do need to be chewed well, and if you do that, then there shouldn't be any issues. But if biting and swallowing without doing the proper chewing, then it could create some problems lower down in the digestive tract because our digestive tract is
That's
very
the idea,
sophisticated.
yeah. The idea being, of course, that the seeds or bits of hard carrot get caught in those little out pouches, which I don't think is really very logical to me, because it's by that stage it's caught up with the motion and the mucus that lines the gastrointestinal tract, and I think that if you chew them well, then there's no reason to exclude them from the diet. So
I agree.
dentures. Dental issues in the elderly become a problem at this point, and another discussion for another day. If you can put any money that you have that's left over into your dental care, because dental care is crucial to a healthy lifestyle. It's associated with better quality of life, it's associated with better nutrition, it's associated with less cardiovascular disease and a whole range of things, just teeth decay aside. So I guess that is another reason why people may choose to avoid those things because they can't chew them. But the bottom line is there's other forms of fiber in the diet that you can eat. If you do have issues with dentistry, are you able to give some examples of those for people that might not be able to chew well the very
Yeah,
beginning?
no, I'm glad you brought that up, Vivian, because it is a real issue for a certain cohort of older people. I think we're taking care of our teeth better these days, and it's rare for me to come across somebody that has a full set of dentures. Usually people have some teeth left, but there are those that don't, and you do need to be careful. So bite-size pieces, so if you're having a granny bread, for example, to cut it into small squares and making sure that you're cutting your food up into small bite-sized pieces, a bit like we would do with people with what we call dysphagia, which we haven't mentioned that word before, but it's not uncommon in certain younger people
dysphagia.
either. Yeah. So not eating, basically Latin for not being able to chew properly.
Not
So
being able to eat, swallow properly and chew properly.
So, and that affects younger people. So it's not just the elderly, but you need to be thinking of along the same line. So small bite-sized pieces, soft. In many cases, I probably wouldn't recommend something that's seedy because it's really hard, you know, without proper teeth. But you could get a wholemeal bread that has been processed enough that has a lot of the goodness of it and still some fiber. And it's cut into bite-sized pieces that you could handle. You know, you wouldn't be having nuts and seeds. You do need to be careful with some of the nut butters because they can be a choking hazard. But if you spread it thinly on a bite-sized piece of bread, you may be okay. And otherwise, soft fruits are plentiful. You know, melons in particular, not so good on the fiber side, but they're still a nutritious food. And other foods you can actually stew. Once upon a time, you know, elderly people used to either bake, you know, my grandma used to bake apples and pears and things, or you can stew fruits. You're still getting a lot of the goodness. It's not quite as good as fresh, but it's okay. And I think with the vegetables, yeah, there's the starchy veggies. So you've got your pumpkins and even potatoes, let's face it, you know, mashed potatoes. Obviously, I'd be recommending a lower glycemic index version, but, you know, there are options there so that you're having still getting fruits and vegetables, you're just having them in a slightly more processed format so that they don't represent a choking hazard. You know, overall, they're good, so people can enjoy them. So I think it's just a matter of tailoring the diet, and that's why, as I said earlier, we talk in generalities, but when somebody sees me, we have to go through that, and I do ask about their teeth. I usually get them to smile at me so I can see their teeth. You know, so that's part of the discussion and the recommendations going forward. So absolutely essential, and I'm glad you raised that point.
And finally, we were talking about exercise before and the effect on laxation, going to the toilet. And we were talking about why the older patients tend to have more constipation. And we haven't even touched on some of the other stuff like a reduction in cholesterol, reduction in blood sugar, or blood glucose is the official term, with a high fiber diet. But just going back to us for a second to exercise, because that interacts with all these things too. Can you tell us a little bit about the latest research regarding exercise and the effect on constipation?
Well, I think you've raised a broader picture. So people, when they think of constipation, tend to think fiber and food. And of course, that is an essential component of it. But the other thing that often goes under the radar, which we haven't discussed yet, is fluids. And people need to drink adequate.
Thank you.
So, yeah, so.
And you
know,
can sip with your food. Sip with
well,
your food
whatever,
if you have
you know. The old 8 glasses of fluids a day is good for the average adult. You can be more precise. The bigger you are, the more you need, and it's between 35 and 45 millilitres of fluids per kilogram body weight. So bigger people need to drink more. But, you know, for the average Australian adult, adult in most parts of the world, you know, around about 8 glasses of fluids a day. And what do we mean by that? Well, you know, water obviously is best for most of us in most conditions, as long as your water supply is safe and doesn't taste too bad. But otherwise, cups of tea or coffee, because that can help, you know, with unsafe water and adds a bit of flavour. You can get non-sugar cordials. If you've got a, you know, a foul tasting water supply, some people in some parts of Australia do. So add a bit of a non-sugar cordial or have a non-sugar soft drink, more for special occasions, obviously. There's plenty of sparkling mineral waters and what have you. So fluids is a fairly generic term. It doesn't just have to be water, but you do need to have that along with your fiber each day. And then the last magic ingredient, which you've raised, and I, you know, they're the three F's: food, fluids, and physical activity. Sorry, my bad spelling. And you know, it's really to get the bowels, to get the body moving, you know, because we're designed to move. And I think what happens is we get older, we get more sedentary. And you know, if you're not having enough fiber and you're not having enough fluids, and then you're not physically active, the combination, you know, inevitably leads to some form of constipation. But as you said, diverticulosis and other more serious conditions. So, you know, the physical activity guidelines, they've just been updated for Australia, which is great. They do include to decrease physical inactivity, which I think is, you know, becoming increasingly a problem. It's not just the planned activity, whether it's walking or, you know, swimming, bicycle riding, whatever, playing sport. You know, it's the inactivity, sitting around on a screen, whatever that screen is. You know, that's important too. So just to get the body moving, because we're built to move, and if you're not, it's going to contribute to constipation. So I think, you know, that's a really important thing that everybody needs to think of. It's not just, I don't know why we tend to focus on food all the time. It's not just food, right?
No, and that's why we have a food and healthy living and lifestyle talk
Exactly.
on this program.
That's right.
One last thing. I keep saying one last thing, but one last thing. On the market, there's various things that make you go, whoopsie, sorry, just disappeared, that make you go to the toilet. Senna is one thing. Senna is not safe in the medium or long term. It damages the nerves and the bowel. And then there's what we call the osmotic medications that make you go to the toilet. And if you have to have these, if you can't have prunes, for example, boil them up with a little bit of lemon juice and a touch of sugar. They're very nice. Drink the prune juice and eat the prunes for breakfast. If you can't have that to avoid constipation and you can't increase your fruit and your fiber, then the next thing would be some of the macro gels that are around. And although I don't normally suggest those as a routine for people that are on a calorie restricted diet and they're not on a fluid restricted diet and dehydration isn't an issue for them, and they don't have heart failure or kidney disease, then check with your doctor before you try that, because, as I say, they are the last resort, but they certainly are a reasonable resort for some groups of people. So I just mentioned those because I think the program wouldn't be complete without.
No, you're right, Vivian, and I do recommend, you know, over the counter preparations, which are often based on psyllium in particular, which I do favour because they're gentle and they're quite effective, and most people would tolerate those. And you can add them to your meals, or you can drink them. So there are different ways of having them. And I think, yeah, you know, there's horses for courses. We have these products for a reason. Food is best, but it's not the only option. So I think we must, you know, keep an open mind and speak to your health professional and work out what's best for you.
Fantastic. Thank you very, very much, Alan. We look forward to speaking again.
Yep, thanks, Vivian. We'll speak again in a fortnight.
Okay. Speak soon.
Bye.
Bye. Bye, everyone.